Friday afternoon deploy is buried under 12 inches of snow, which is why my microphone sounds so terrible.
Oh, there it is. It says it's recording.
Yeah. Everybody should. Did you get a pop-up? Like, what happens when I did that?
No, it just starts, says in red it's recording.
Okay. Yeah, down at the bottom.
Good. Well, I'm glad everyone was notified so I couldn't clandestinely start recording from everybody. We got a new tool we're using, and it's hopefully going to improve things.
Mm-hmm.
So far, it's been pretty good. Audio quality is the thing I'm most excited to hopefully get some gains on. We'll see. We want to do some hardware improvements for everybody, that, like, literally everybody in the company, so that they can have nice quality conference calls, but also when we're on the podcast, everybody can contribute in that way. But for now, we'll see how this goes. I remember listening to some of the most recent podcasts and forgetting that I was joining via Zoom, and then hearing myself going like, oh, that sounds weird. I was like, yeah. Oh yeah, I've been on the other side of a Zoom call for almost a year because Casey's been recording everything. So hopefully this will kind of overcome that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We adapted to we overcome. Yeah.
This is the new normal. So we've got a cloud-based podcasting tool we're using, and hopefully it is worth the extra effort it takes to use it. I don't know if I trust it just being browser-based.
It does leave some room for performance variety.
Right? And, I mean, I'm not naive enough to not think that Zoom's desktop app is just an Electron app. Surely it is. It's what everyone, like, no one builds native, unless you're doing, like, hard processing, no one builds native apps anymore.
And from an audiophile point of view, I mean, you don't need great quality for spoken word. Like 96 kilobytes per second is usually kind of standard for spoken word.
Yeah.
As long as it's consistent, that's the, you know, across the board, that's what's noticeable.
Which they warn you about. Did you guys get like that list of warnings when you signed in for this?
Maybe. Yeah. Was there a checklist to click I agree?
Kind of. It was like, you have to give permission, use headphones, make sure your internet's good, and don't ever change tabs, which is not going to happen with us. Like, I know us better than to expect it.
I didn't see that it said that.
Yeah.
Willow's not even on the tab right now. It's just on a completely different
tab. No, I am right now, but I wasn't. Okay.
Yeah, apparently they said some browsers will throttle quality if you leave the active tab.
Well, surely that's not Chrome.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, with Chrome, everything's a new browser instance, like,
yeah,
literally everything. So in that regard, I guess it's kind of implicitly right that that would not be the case.
It seems logical that it would downgrade your quality, like just overall. If you had a video going and then you switch tabs, you're not watching the video. You're probably listening to it maybe still. So I mean.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
You notice anything? I'm in another tab.
No, can't tell any difference.
Well, it seems to be fine. So yeah,
I just noticed Moose isn't up there anymore. That's all.
No, he's not.
We'll get him back up eventually. We may have to
introduce him all day. He's just been staring at me all day. Like
he's probably trying to make it warmer outside.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what my dogs have done to me for half the day, too. They just look at me like, all right, let's go outside. And then get to the door, and they just look up at me. And I'm like, I know. I make food. I make manna come from the heavens, but I can't do that. I'm sorry.
I've only got so much control. Your mind can't fathom that, though.
No, they can't. No, they can't. Hodges ran outside for a while, though, and ran around, and So he got all that out of his system. He's sleeping over there now.
That's good.
I don't know if he wants to go outside or just do something. Like just play.
Yeah. Pent up energy.
There might be puppy noises in the background from me, and I've got a puppy who occasionally wants attention, though he's getting better and better at kind of being autonomous. So we'll see. Maybe. It's a fun experiment. So for those who don't know, we are in the middle of a polar vortex in Arkansas. We're like on the brink of a polar vortex.
Mm-hmm. North America's in a polar vortex right now.
But like, yeah. Where we are at this point in time as of recording is we're just starting to get the polar vortex that a lot of other folks have either already experienced or will experience. I think everybody will have had it. Yeah, because we're at a like we're a week out on our releases. So everybody else will have already gotten it by then too. So that this is like us bracing for the big storm and going to buy all the things from the stores. Did anybody go out and try and stock up this afternoon? Or they have plans to try and stock up tomorrow maybe?
Got some stuff to pick up tomorrow, some grocery pickup.
Yeah, I got to do it too because otherwise I will seriously not have any food. I already have.
Did you already put your order in?
I don't order food. Okay. I just go to the store.
I wasn't sure if you did like online pickup.
Mm. No.
Yeah, we've been doing pickups all week. I mean, it's we got two little ones in the house, so there's constant restocking. It's all, for sure. All over the place.
I was so sad today. I bought a box of Quaker oats with brown sugar inside cereal. I'm not a cereal guy. Like, there's tons of folks that are cereal people. I'm not a cereal guy. That's like my one cereal. And I was sent to the store earlier this week, and cereal was on my list. So I bought several cereals, but I was like, while I'm here in the cereal aisle, I'll grab the cereal that I like. I bought it. My kids crushed that in 2 days. 2 days. And I had no shot at it. This morning, I saw the box tipped over because I was about to take them all to school. Like, did you guys eat all the cereal? And everyone was like pointing their fingers. Like, I didn't get the last of it. I wanted some of that.
I remember those days. Like, it's funny, you kind of miss those days after they move out, and then you're making like so much pot roast that you're eating it for 4 days, remembering, like, oh yeah, that's need to consolidate this meal.
What's nice is I've figured out what they don't like, and I get the stuff that I like that nobody else in the house likes. And so everybody's like not touching it. Like, nobody else in the house likes salt and vinegar chips. So I can just get that and they will be just for me.
I wish that was the case. My kids love salt and vinegar chips too. I saw you listed that on your like list of snacks you like.
That's part of why it's one of my favorites, is because I can eat it and I don't have to worry about it disappearing.
Yeah.
But yeah, we got one kid who's not allergic or anything like that. He just doesn't like peanut butter. So Reese's Pieces and Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, if he gets those at Halloween or in Christmas, we get to eat them. It's a real shame.
Yeah, darn it.
You're doing a great job as a father just getting those away.
Yeah, getting that out of there so he doesn't have to worry about it. Yeah.
We appreciate your service.
I do what I can. A little too much.
Yeah. Unfortunately, my kids really like a lot of the stuff I like in regards to food. I love when they share my interests outside of food because I get to experience so much with them. I've learned recently how valuable it is to like just bring them with me on everything I do, like even running errands and all that stuff, just quality time being around them. And so it's even better when they like really enjoy the stuff I do rather than they feel just kind of obligated out of proximity to do the stuff I do. But when they love the food I love, that's when there's conflict. There's a finite amount of that. Like, there's a zero-sum game when it comes to dinner being ready. And you all love this, and I do too. So I've had to start, like, deferring. And because they're all getting big enough where they eat more than they used to before they were small enough. It's like it didn't matter. And now it's
that's like, just that animal instinct. It's like, oh, totally. I'm going to snap at you if you get close to my food. Totally.
Yeah. Food competition is
the funniest thing. So I've got this. We've got this puppy now, that we have been raising. I think he's been in podcasts already at this point, but we've started bringing our older dog in because it's so cold, and we brought him in the other night, and this little puppy who's I think he's 8 weeks old now. He walked over to the big dog's bowl and started eating his food. And the big dog came back because the big dog would like grab some food, take it away, and eat it as Pike. And then Jack would go over, Jackson, and go over and we started eating his food. And Pike went to come back to get some food. And that puppy was like, "Nah, son, this is mine now." And he was just like growling at him. like Pike was so confused that this little puppy was like, "Back up, no!" And he was just like giving it to him, and he went on and he just like hate ate that food in front of Pike. I'm the alpha now. Look at me, I'm the alpha now. This is what was terrible, because we were laughing because he kept eating and eating and eating, and he was just like, it was clearly a dominance thing. And then he went to bed, and he woke up like an hour later, woke us up, and like every 30 minutes he woke up to puke because he had just stuffed himself. He was so like, "I'm gonna insert my dominance." This puppy woke up every 30 minutes for like 3 hours through the night to puke. So I had to stay out in the office area with him and just like sleep, like doze on the couch. If we left him in the cage, he'd like wake up and start yelping, or not the cage, the pen, excuse me. He'd wake up and start yelping to get out, and I'd have to like get up and like not have that cold war that you have with a partner where you're both laying in bed and nobody wants to get up, but somebody's got to get up. Like, we wanted to avoid that cold war. So I was the guy who's like, "I'll do it." So I got up and I stayed up with him and like let him puke it all out. And finally, it was like having a drunk friend that you took home to his apartment just to make sure he was okay.
You got a hold of those floppy ears back.
Yeah.
He's a good now. So now that we've already talked through hungover dogs,
that's our pets and food segment now.
There's a new voice in the podcast. So obviously Willow and Alan are here, and I'm Tyrell. But we've got Daniel with us. We're glad to say is the newest member of Lofty, not just the newest person on the podcast. So, Daniel, we're glad to have you on the Lofty team. Glad you're able to make it on the podcast. And welcome.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
Frequent listener, first-time guest.
Yeah. I've known Daniel for a while now. It's been fun to kind of, like, for those who don't know the kind of ecosystem in Northwest Arkansas, which would be most of our listeners, I imagine, it thinks it's bigger than it is. And so it's got high aspirations, but it's a small tech ecosystem. And so you kind of know most of the folks, at least in some sense. And Daniel and Casey and I, like the three of us, have even kind of all circled around each other for the last, almost 10 years.
Yeah, and, it's been a bit.
Yeah, and kind of fed each other potential jobs and talked with each other about stuff. And we've all worked in different tech. I think at one point I was in Ruby, Casey was in Python, and you were in PHP. And so we were all in different tech stacks and all this stuff. And the clouds aligned recently, and we were able to we had the perfect project and perfect client to bring someone with Daniel's like vast experience with the good parts of PHP.
we'll say modern PHP.
The modern parts.
it's learned from other tool sets. Still kind of got some baggage, but
sure. Well, I mean, most things have baggage, for sure. PHP's got unique baggage though because of where it started. We'll go into that, I'm sure, a lot. So Daniel's with us now, and we're excited to have him.
Indeed.
Yeah, go ahead. Perfect. I just love it. I love it.
Sorry. No, it's more profound. Nice. Glad to have somebody do that PHP stuff now.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. Well, and we find ourselves, we have worked with PHP projects periodically all throughout the life of Lofty because so much of the web is built on PHP. And like by design, I mean, PHP was so dominant in the early stages. I mean, it was like the only way to get stuff into a persistent data store out of your HTML for a while. Or at least the most dominant. I don't know that it was ever quote unquote the only one, but yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's surprisingly a lot of companies in Northwest Arkansas that are still doing it. Now, the ironic part about that is, you know, like a lot of other cities, we've had our meetups and everything, and you'll find just about every meetup in the world, well, up until about last year where it kind of dried up a little bit, but you could find just about whatever language you wanted except PHP. And then we've even in Arkansas, right, in the state of Arkansas, we got one of the developer of one of the bigger PHP frameworks, and we still haven't had much of a strong representation. It's very strange, but there's a ton of developers, PHP developers around town. There's not really the big community around it, I guess. I don't know what it is.
I had never put that together, Matt. You're absolutely right.
I would get recruiters like hunting for PHP developers and be like, well, have you tried so-and-so? Or, you know, they have no way to track them down because there's not a meetup.
It was easy to find Ruby developers. You just showed up at a Ruby shop with beer and pizza, and like they would just like come out of the woodworks, and you could recruit them. And it's what recruiters did for like the whole time that Ruby was kind of the big language in the area. Like I was a Ruby developer during kind of that heyday. There's still some Ruby shops around, but like I just knew like when I went to meetup. Dinner steak. I'm good with dinner. I'll be fine. It was guaranteed some recruiter would be there with everything we needed for the night. We just roll into one of the offices of the companies here. I won't list them, but because it varied. But never had I considered that Laravel is built.
Yeah, we'd occasionally show up at the Ruby meetups or whatever for free pizza, and then I'm totally learning Ruby or whatever. Yeah.
that's fascinating. Huh. I wonder what it is.
I think it's just a different. I don't know, with Ruby especially, you had Rails kind of knitting a whole bunch of the community together, right. and you know, Django's pretty strong representation, but PHP's got a million frameworks, and so it might be that everybody was just in such a different world. You know, WordPress had its own thing for a long time in town. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of WordPress meetups. Yeah.
Okay. I went to a couple of those when I was getting started in tech around here.
But there's not a lot of developers that are going to that. It's almost all like content managers and
designers and
Well, that's true for my kind of journey. Was I started with PHP with CMSs and then like just kind of progressed from there. I don't remember. I remember hearing about Symfony only because I was a Drupal developer, and there was a big fuss because with Drupal 8, they were gutting a bunch of stuff and bringing in Symfony, and everyone was losing their mind because of these huge architectural shifts in Django, the Drupal CMS. But it was making it more in DC. It was making it more kind of like common to what was becoming the norm with MVC frameworks on the web. And I kind of just decided to jump the line, and instead of sticking with Drupal through that transition, I was like, well, screw this, I'll just go get a Rails developer instead. This is where it's headed. And I was glad I made that switch, obviously, but it's been interesting for sure to kind of watch that. I hadn't put that together. So the community was what drew me to Rails, weirdos and all. I think that sense of community is key particularly for incoming developers, because they feel supported. Like, I knew I felt like if I were a Rails developer, I could find support. I could find people to ask questions. And for someone coming in with a self-taught background, being an English major and learning it that way, rather than coming in through some sort of formal education or even a boot camp, I knew I was going to have to lean hard on community.
There was at it with Zen Framework for a while, but
that's right.
You know,
I forgot about Zen.
I think until Laravel rolled around, it wasn't really as welcoming and open and you know, at least not in our neck of the woods. That changed a lot of things and kind of brought a whole lot of modern practices, and it made it much more pleasant.
I don't know. Laravel's got kind of a thing, you know.
Yeah.
Was there a big community down in? Because were you working with Laravel when you were down in Central Arkansas, though?
I started doing that. Yeah.
Was there a lot of kind of community and stuff around that down there?
I wouldn't know. I'm not a community person.
Well said. That's all right. Did you feel like when you jumped into it, though, that there was, even if it wasn't like immediate community support, did you feel like you'd be able to get questions answered quickly, like through forums and Stack Overflow and stuff?
Online, yeah. Looked around it online, that kind of stuff, questions. Yeah,
they've got some good video tutorials. There's one or two specific sites that are just, they do deep dives on Laravel, the framework, and then they'll do some stuff on Vue, because there's a lot of symbiosis there.
Yeah, we've noticed that.
And then the docs for Laravel are amazing. Like, you can deep dive into it from the API level, but like Taylor spends a real large amount of his time, or used to. He may have somebody else working on it now, but he was grooming those docs regularly, and they are a deep resource of like just the style, the approach that's taken, and all those things. And it's good. It was easy to kind of just dive in. And they're real good about, like, if somebody else has got like a good package out there, and now that PHP's got a good package manager, they're good about using tools that are good at what they do, you know, not reinventing the wheel, giving people support in certain areas, especially if it's an underpinning package that really keeps things afloat. Like, there was a testing tool that was the supporter was leaving. He had a situation where he needed to hand it over, and they just took it because everybody needed it. It was something that everybody depended on, and so they just took it over. It's a pretty good open source environment where they kind of take care of everything, make sure it stays alive.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. You're referring to Composer when you're talking about the package manager, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that brought us a lot further into the modern era.
For sure.
That's because there's a million conflicts, just like all the other ones.
Yeah. Now we all get conflict held together. We can all share that pain. You were working on Linux systems from a Windows machine with your last place, right?
I got lucky, and we were in a company that got acquired, and I had been allowed to sort of, it was one of those do first and then ask permission later situations, right, where I set up a Linux box, because it was so much smoother to maintain these Linux servers and do the testing and all that. But when we got acquired, they wanted everybody with kind of more recent machines. And they just kind of bulk ordered one thing from one manufacturer. So everybody got the same thing. And it was all these really beefy Windows 10 machines. And about that time, Microsoft bought all the things, like bought GitHub, bought everything, and started doing Linux development and Linux server drivers and getting SQL Server to run on Linux. And so the timing worked out for the Windows subsystem Linux. So I started doing quite a bit of development through that. And the first iteration was slow because it wanted to do its own thing in its own way. And it still ran off of Hyper-V, I think, for powering. And, but it didn't have a way to mount the Windows stuff in the Linux subsystem or vice versa. You didn't have a good interoperability. But then with WSL2, it's a lot better. It's a lot faster too. Yes.
Do you ever use, what was that? Was it Cygwin? There was something I used way back. That, and I remember the first time I used WSL, I was like, no, that's worse than this tool that's been around for like a decade. I can at least operate on the file system with this other tool. That was a mess, though. I remember the time you'd start it up and you would have to do an update on it. And back then, Windows didn't have a package manager or anything like that.
Yeah.
Now they've got chocolatey. I'm not sure how to say it, but I've used it a time or two on Windows.
I did for a while. Tried out the Vagrant and VirtualBox combination and everything, and you know, it's all that stuff so much easier on Linux or presumably also a Mac.
It still kind of is, because even on Mac you have to run a virtual machine to be able to run Docker. You know, and on my Ubuntu laptop, I can just run Docker right on the operating system.
I like that. It's been nice to just, and really with everything running in browsers now, and even a lot of the development tools have Linux binaries that you can install. And there's not a whole lot you can't do with a. This is the year of the Linux desktop. for my purposes, it's fine. Like I have a machine I dual boot into Windows for games, but I even had a couple of Steam games running on Linux for a while. It's just, I kind of like to keep those two worlds apart so that I don't get tempted to goof around on a work in or tempted to work when I should be playing a game.
Yeah, I did the dual boot for a while, and mostly I live in a Unix world. That sounds kind of weird to say now that I hear that come out.
You know, it plays really well with everything. We got a NAS that's based on Linux. We got a couple of devices that are Linux around the house all on the same network. They can see each other's drives on the network and don't have to do anything. Kind of, there's some permission hoops you have to jump through with Windows, and Windows treats permissions vastly differently than Unix, Linux, BSD. It's a big paradigm shift when you got to mix those two. And we have, you know, if you have Android devices, they can see a lot of that stuff fine because it's a lower barrier. It's nice. I mean, every now and then there's still some weird quirks, like, maybe the Wi-Fi adapter doesn't start up immediately when you open the laptop or something.
But. Yeah, I've got one that has one little incompatibility with the NVIDIA processor I'm running that most of the time I don't notice because I don't play video, like high quality video on that machine often. Whenever I do, it puts a little line right across the screen there. But other than that, works great. And like when it comes to reading EPUBs and especially CBR and CBZs, you know, comic book files, I like how Nautilus just just works. Like I can see the covers of the comics and stuff like that, and then the document reader just will read them. I don't have to go download something like it would for Windows or even Mac. You know, you have to get some kind of plug in and stuff to see the thumbnails and even be able to read it. And all those files are the CBR and the CBZs. Those are just zipped up JPEGs. Is all those files are, which is all you need for a comic book.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to when they do like the e-ink displays with color. That will be perfect for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want that so badly. I do too.
Hate
reading backlit things. I sit and stare at a backlit screen all day and I don't want a light shining in my face. Ironically, yeah. As I sit with a light shining in my face.
Yeah, that's the
only best thing. But that's probably the reason you don't want to do that is because you've done that all day, and when you're taking some time to read, you don't want to have to do it even more. Yeah, it's much clearer to read the fonts on an ebook, in my opinion. It's one of my favorite ways to read. I've got a Kobo now that will let me still sideload things, and it's been pretty nice.
I've got an old Kindle that lets me do that as well, and I don't use it's not backlit. You know, it's the old style, and that is nice. I feel like my eyes rest. A little bit.
You do have to turn on a lamp or something. Yep. When you go.
Yeah.
That's the thing. No, that's the thing I don't want.
I want the warm yellow light, though, instead of the blue. I've got one
that's front lit, so the light casts itself down on the front of the e-ink, and that's gotcha. Pretty nice, so I can read with lamp off.
Mm. You can get that one. App. I don't know. They probably have it for Mac. I had it on my Windows, and it changes throughout the day, and it turns orange.
Oh, you're talking about Flux is what it's called on the Mac.
Yeah,
I use Flux.
It's that on Windows.
It's what on Windows?
It's called the same thing.
Okay. Yeah, I use Flux on. Well, and Mac tried to, in typical Apple fashion, like we'll just do that for you. You don't need Flux anymore.
But
I still install Flux. Like it's one of the first things I install.
I don't know if they have that in phones.
So I used to jailbreak my iPhone so I could put Flux on it because I wanted that transition. Like basically once my phone gets old enough that I'm comfortable with breaking it, if I do that by accident, I'll jailbreak it just to be like, what's jailbreaking like these days? Let's see. And, because I've jailbroken my phone for years, even did it like on Craigslist for money for a little while for folks. But I use Flux. I like it. But I'm also all right with using a lamp and a light and an e-ink reader. So it's
what you got to use with
the book.
Yeah, so, it's nice to be able to like sit out in a hammock in the. You know, spring when it's you know not a polar vortex outside, and be able to sit and read the device because on a tablet that's a hopeless case.
Mm-hmm. The new Kindles let you turn it down. Like there's this, I think it's Paperwhite, let you basically turn the backlighting off and it works.
You mean when it's like really sunny outside?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that sucks.
For real,
green glare.
It's funny that like on these tablets, the reading conditions are directly opposite of what you would have wanted for like a print book.
I mean,
just think about that. On the ones you're talking about, you can read them in the sun, but you can't read them in the dark. The other ones you can read in the dark, but you can't read in the sun.
Exactly.
Yep.
That's why you should be able to turn it off and on.
Yeah, I keep seeing these articles where they're talking about these color e-ink displays, and that would be tech books look awful on the e-reader because tech's always got the color coded code examples. You might have some diagrams or something like that, and you think about like science textbooks or something like that. It'd be really nice to do full color display. Yeah. If they get that, man, that would be, I would imagine that'd be a game changer.
I think they've been talking about full color inking for years, though.
Yeah. What do you say, Will?
I think some book apps have like a color tint sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think the one I was using the other day might have that. And the one I use, the playbooks, I use like the dark. I use the black page with the white words. Mm-hmm. They probably still mess with your eyes, but it's better than the alternative.
Yeah. I agreed, yeah.
For sure. Yeah. No, there's a, I don't even know the name of the product, but there's a product that I get sold on Instagram pretty regularly. That's like a tablet that you can write on. It's e-ink display only. Mm. And it's just like, how you've got my number like locked down. I don't know how you know I want that so bad. But it does, it still doesn't do everything I need it to do. But like,
right.
Like, yeah, it's this weird combination of like, it scratches the itch of like the old English major in me that's just like, I just want to read an old book from your computers. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
build my own boat, like a
what is it? Boat. We've been doing that as a
book smell on the tablet. So that's,
yeah,
that'll be next level.
I think you'll get the, if they can do that. I mean, it's like, you know, we probably still enjoy physically writing and the idea of paper. It's just the being able to reuse something is pretty handy too. If you could like get those two things together.
I mean, if you want the old paper smell, just get the can of warmers out.
There you go.
I got one for Christmas. It's approximate of the smell.
What was it though?
It was Alyssa got it from a bookstore. I can't remember where. It may not even be open. This was pre-COVID. But she got me a candle that is like book paper smell. It's out in the office. like I said, it's approximate. I think it's really the binding glue is what I like. But I'm one of those weird book smellers. As soon as I get a book. And sometimes, if I'm not sure if I'm going to buy it, like it comes down to smell. I don't like the smell of the binding glue. I'll put it back. It's not worth it.
Yeah, it's kind of the appeal of that Dixon Street bookstore. You get in there. Part of it is like the maze of trying to discover your what it is you're looking for. The other is that the book smell.
Just being submerged.
Yes.
If you're not in Northwest Arkansas, Dixon Street Bookstore is this fantastic used bookstore where it's almost like a maze, and you can totally get lost in there. But you'll find some pretty cool stuff.
They sell maps.
That's awesome.
That are made to look like maps from fantasy books. But yeah,
nice.
It's pretty sweet.
Nice.
Yeah. Did you guys ever hear of LiveScribe or use a LiveScribe pen?
That sounds familiar.
I used it years ago, and what it would do was it was a smart pen, and it would record sound around you while you were writing. So you would start writing, you'd hit record on the paper, and it was reading the paper. So you had to use their notebooks. And as you wrote, it was like a dot matrix. It was like reading the pattern underneath you as you wrote. And so it would sync what you were writing with what was recording. And so you could, you'd take your notes and then you could tap on a word and it would play the audio from around when you wrote that word. Hmm. And then you could take it and digitize it all off of the pen. And so you'd have a digital copy of your notes because it can like, basically the pen was also capturing all of that because of the background on the paper. And so you'd have a digital copy of your notes that you could click on and hear the lecture at different points and things like that. So
That's cool.
it was pretty cool. I don't think most folks use it anymore, but I know I bought it when I went to college or when I went back to college. I was a note taker for the School of Academic Success because I knew I had that pen. I was just like, oh, I'm gonna make some money and pay for this $100 pen or whatever much it costs, or $200 pen. taking notes for people. And so sure enough, people would ask for notes, and I'm like, ha ha, I'll send them to you. And I'm just like, sorry, my handwriting is terrible, but you can just listen to the lecture. Just like, and it worked. I got paid enough.
And you had to digitize notes too, like the printed out or what?
No, I didn't have to print them out. I could email them. Thankfully. But I mean,
no, but it was typed is what I mean.
They can convert it to, you could, there was a, some kind of third party plugin that would convert it to text, like type text as well. But it had to like learn your handwriting, and I've got the handwriting of a serial killer slash pharmacist. So
it would never figure out. It would just be questionable.
Exactly. That's it did all right with mine eventually. But it was never great. So I had to correct the whole time.
I didn't take notes in school because I can't learn that way.
Are you a visual learner?
No, I have to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Taking notes distracts me from listening.
Yeah, I was going to say visual learners usually like taking notes.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and the audibler is just like to be there. I waver between like I'm a listener and hands on. Like I usually like it explained to me how to do it, and then kind of guide me through doing it, and then I feel like I can learn that way.
Yeah, I'm definitely a learn by doing kind of person.
Yeah, that's definitely with code. That seems like that's the easiest way to learn new things. Yeah. It's to have some sort of excuse to learn some new shiny thing.
And then I'm always show me the code. Like I want to just, you know, jump in any book I get that I usually learn better by just kind of following along with the code examples and then kind of reading their explanation for it, but doing that way.
I mean, that's one of those things you basically have to learn by doing. There's no way.
Yeah.
You can't write notes about it. That doesn't work. You can work it a little bit, but it's not good enough.
Yeah.
That's one of those video sites for the Laravel community. Laracast is pretty good about that because you can just watch him kind of step through these ideas, and he might go through them a few different ways. And then I've also found like deep diving in other people's projects is kind of nice too, because there's always some tricks that I never thought to put in place that are pretty nice to stumble on when you can find them.
I've learned a lot through Django source code like that when it comes to Python and DRF code.
I think browsing through the source of frameworks is very helpful.
Yeah.
It's time consuming, but it's really eye opening.
Yeah.
So, I have
mad respect for people who can do that kind of coding, because that's a level of abstraction that I don't typically have to do.
For sure. It's helpful to get in there and see. Like I know that's where I was really appreciative when I made the switch from Rails to Django. I've talked about in the podcast was that Django encourages it, whereas Rails is just like, no, don't even worry about it, bro. We got you. We got you. You don't need to know how I do that. Just know that I did it for you and be grateful. You know? Like my tweet. So
their docs suck. I don't like their docs at all, honestly.
Rails docs?
Yeah, I don't like them.
Yeah. It's something about
honestly, you know, like the visual design makes you not want
to
read it.
I haven't looked at the Rails docs in forever.
That's for sure.
And Willow is throwing shade at like just literally the UI, which is awesome.
Yeah, no, I 100% knew what she meant, and I agree. Like I've tried. I mean, not that I particularly enjoy Django's. You know,
I think the Django ones are good because they're like pretty clean.
I think I think it's not so much
this now.
I don't like. It's all the crap that ends up when I'm Googling Django, and then I just get a million Medium articles. I'm like, no, I just want the Django docs. Like, I want to know how this random person does it. Like, show me the Django way to do it.
Yeah, I do remember that now. Those actually are pretty rough on the eyes. That's funny. I didn't even consider that.
Yeah, and that does matter a lot when you're trying to get somebody to use your stuff. Or, you know.
And they start you off with scaffolding. And I remember talking to Hayden about that. Hayden was our Rails developer for a while. And I remember asking him about that. Like, how do you feel about scaffolding? He's like, oh, no, it's terrible. Don't use that. And that's the first thing they walk me through. I hear some scaffolding. And, like, look, now you've got a blog app. Like, yeah, exactly. I don't understand what I just did.
You've officially just beat WordPress. That's all you needed to do, right?
Yeah.
There's this one thing, the loop. Once you know that, you're good.
Okay. What's funny is,
oh my god, those are in more docs that suck.
Yeah.
WordPress codex sucks.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so bad at explaining stuff. Whenever I have to do WordPress stuff, there's this one dude on YouTube that's really good at it, and he's got a video on everything. And
who's that? Let's give him a shout out. Who do you recommend watching for YouTube videos?
His name is Alejandro Castellani or something.
Okay.
He's Italian, I think.
Nice.
But anyway, he has good WordPress videos.
Nice.
That can be helpful for sure. What's funny was you mentioned the UX on the Rails docs, like turning you off. And Daniel, every time I hit the composer page, I'm just like, oh. Like I shudder. Just a whole looking web page. Like, it's 2003. What's going on?
Because even PyPI got an update like a year or so ago. So now it doesn't look that bad.
I think it's just the graphic. I think it's just the graphic of the crazy guy with the wand in his hand that just feels so old.
It looks like Beethoven to me.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely, I think that's probably what they're going for. Yeah. But yeah, every time like I've had to like dive into Composer and I hit that page, I'm just like, oh man, come on.
Yeah, no, I've never been here, and I'm going to try not to be there again.
it's like
that was a hand drawn. It was a hand drawn picture of a conductor.
Yep.
Clip art.
Exactly.
Yep.
And then. Yeah, then it's just like, and then I might as well be working with like Jenkins at that point too. Like, there's just like this whole hierarchy of like the tech patriarchy, old white man icons all over bad tech. That
what?
Oh, it's a joke, Willa.
Jenkins,
not like real patriarchy, just like Jenkins is similar.
Icons. I might have just stumbled on a Jenkins thing in a certain project recently, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I'll tell you more about that later.
Yeah.
Well, it's some detail.
Oh, it is. You're right. Okay, I know.
There you go.
It's just, there's two young children on this page. What are you talking about? They're diverse children, too.
Which page?
What page?
Jenkins.io page.
Oh, the Jenkins page? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Have they upgraded Jenkins when I wasn't paying attention? Oh. Oh, I see.
You gotta go to the page a little
bit. Wow.
They're there.
I did not mean to laugh that hard at just a YouTube still. No context. I've not watched it, but I didn't expect that.
I got really confused with the Dark Reader plugin. It does a thing to the Jenkins guy.
Oh, does it really?
Yeah. I was very confused. That turned it off. I was like, oh yeah, no, that's the Jenkins guy there.
That's funny. I wonder what's the composition of that graphic then that it can manipulate it that way?
You know, I get SVG maybe? It may be an SVG that they are. Yeah, because he's got his eyes closed in that one. So
I wonder.
Well, does that mean that somebody just like they just don't have the rights to it? Or they
I don't know. They had the rights to it if they manipulated it enough.
That's a good question.
Here's my homework. Don't make it look like I did it, but just change it up a little bit.
Oh, Jenkins. I've never used Jenkins, but I've never heard a reason for me to use Jenkins.
I've used it. It's effective for what it does. I didn't have a negative experience with it. I think at the time, I mean, this was ages ago, so the tool set now is much slicker. Mm. But yeah, we were doing some kind of early CI/CD with some of that. It was a while back, several jobs ago.
Many moons, way back there.
Lifetimes ago, no.
Yeah, that's a name I haven't heard for a very long time. I'm sure I botched that quote. So I sent you as a part of your onboarding and welcome to the Python world and like your slow migration to the light, a couple of articles, one of which was because Medium's got me dialed in and they know how to send me stuff.
Drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, drink it. Come on. I sent that article about pushing the Django ORM to its limits. And what's funny is I didn't even read the day it was published. This was published in like 2019.
Oh, okay.
But you said you read it and had some questions. And so I thought it would be good to talk through your questions based on a random guy's post on Medium, which we've already taken issue with after like reading just a few. So hopefully your questions are easily thrown out. What's that, Willow?
Kind of early-ish 2019.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, April 2019. It was based off a DjangoCon Europe talk. It was converted to a blog post. We'll go from there. But yeah, so you said you had some questions or thoughts from it.
Well, yeah, and it seems like maybe the date might have been a factor in this, but early on it kind of mentioned the limits of the ORM not being able to do any real raw queries. And I got to thinking about how many of the places I've worked where we ended up needing pretty badly a very exposed access to the query builder itself, you know, something a little more wide open than the ORM. I mean, I've worked with companies that were still using DB2 as their main data source, and you know, it's totally non-normalized. You're not going to get very much with just a pre-built select, but it sounds like that you can actually get a little further up and make more complicated requests. So that was one thing that stood out to me. But otherwise, it looks very similar to several other ORMs I've used in the PHP world.
So what I'm trying to look at to see if there was just some confusion was...
Did they even use Q in this thing?
Yeah, they don't think they even mention Q.
No, they're heavy in the annotations, which is an older way of doing a lot of things.
Yeah, that was my concern. Was like it's definitely,
yeah,
skewing older.
I remember doing hourly annotation to like aggregate stuff from the Twitter API back when that was a thing.
Yeah, there is a PHP ORM that gives you the option to use annotations, and there's some folks who do care for that. And there's a lot of other ORMs that don't do that at all, which is my preference personally. But because
there's go ahead.
Those annotations, I mean, in my IDs, they don't usually show up very boldly, so it's easy to kind of miss some details.
Yeah, for sure.
Annotate and aggregate are pretty commonly used in the ORM, but yeah, they mentioned
that. You mentioned that you could write SQL.
Yeah. You can. There's just a. I think it's just raw, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what's crazy is that that article says like you can't just write raw SQL, and you can ask Jeremy Welkley, who I chastise on a regular basis for putting raw SQL in our Django code, and he'll have to come back on the podcast to defend himself now, and it'll be good. But he definitely put raw SQL all over the Django code where we were last colleagues, and so it's definitely there. I was surprised.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see when that got added to see if
just do model objects raw. Write some SQL.
Yeah, I mean, just tell them SQL, and I will come for you.
I will do that. That they allow you to do it.
Was that Willow?
Nerd dogs. They say like, don't do this.
Yeah.
But you can.
They discourage it, and they should, because there's the temptation if you're a SQL wizard, maybe you don't want to learn this ORM, and you're just going to write everything as SQL, you know. Yeah. But but it'll do a lot of your standard things and pretty painlessly. But every once in a while, kind of like I mentioned, I think before we were doing the podcast, but it's probably come up on here before of returning GeoJSON straight from Postgres by using that raw functionality. And Postgres got some nice functions that let you just build out a JSON response back from it.
Yeah, there's often a new feature or some sort of a budding standard that hasn't really propagated out throughout the database community that you're not going to have access to through an ORM. You've got to find some other way to kind of force that to happen. It seems like the geocoding is one of those things that at this point now it's probably it got to be close to coming a standard, but you know, maybe 5 years ago it was pretty new. You didn't see dedicated database types for that. So I would expect that's one of those things that, you know, we'll start seeing be a first-class citizen in the ORM.
It's in the ORM with Django through GeoDjango,
it almost is a first-class citizen. It's in a contributor package because it used to be a third-party package, I believe, that they ended up incorporating. And it does have, you know, gives you GIST fields to work with, different geometries and stuff, and then you can do some querying.
And for the right thing, like for the right queries, doing that geospatial stuff through the ORM makes sense. Like Alan's about to do some work for one of our current clients that's in the geospatial like sphere, and where we'll be kind of saying like, is this point geometry within a certain radius of this other point geometry? And that'll be great to do through the ORM because that's not going to be expensive. But when we were marshaling just like loads of geospatial data straight out of the database into JSON, like it was just like Python was just like, get exhausted, man. Like going up a flight of stairs, it was just bogged down. It was crazy.
It was a massive amount of data on that project, like thousands of points overlaid with like, you know, a few, like 50 geometries. And it was pretty crazy. We were pushing it to the limit.
It was far more data than was able to be visibly grokked.
And it's going
to be real. More
than eyes could intake. Yes.
It was just, the stakeholder, the client there was just like, I want the data like in their face, just like drown them in data. Take their hand and shove it in the data.
Then you can just remove what you know. But first all the data.
Put everything there, and then give them a ton of buttons, knobs, and switches so they can turn everything off. Because that's what everybody wants. Completely overwhelm me, and then make me figure out the UX to manage this.
It was fun though. It was we drank from the fire hose for a few weeks.
We did.
Just like the Tiger table that like PostGIS will install. I was reading about that. I guess that's based on like census data or something is actually what that is. It's a database with some geographical data in there that has to do with how PostGIS can do some of those geospatial query that it can do.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I forget where I stumbled onto that just a couple of days ago.
That's like my house now. Awesome. So Moose has got what is on the back of Moose's sweater, Willow?
Some kind of monster thing.
It looks like a Pac-Man ghost from where I was seeing.
It does look like that.
It's pretty great. So, and is he a Yorkie or a Maltese?
He's a Maltipoo.
Oh,
the water bottle.
That's how you keep it quiet.
get sprayed.
Yeah, they hate it.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah,
you go.
That's just the FedEx guy dropping off their food. You know,
I was about to say somebody rang the doorbell, didn't they? They didn't feed your sign.
Yeah. That was the chewy delivery.
Conveniently. That's funny. Well, any other questions from that article or anything else from that article that sticks out, Daniel, that we feel the need to defend ourselves with?
Well, I mean, it's a little different take on how to handle subqueries, but I don't really think it's super confusing. It's just different than some of the other ones I've looked at. There was an interesting little bit in there about avoiding race conditions. That was kind of...
Mm-hmm. It's funny you mentioned that with the transaction atomic. That's there. I'm trying to... I can't think of a place where I've had to organically use that.
We used to do that last project we worked on together. I don't remember what it was because I remember you and I thinking about there's got to be a way to do this. And then, transition atomic. And then, but I don't remember what it was.
We had an issue with a parser, I think. When we were ingesting some files. Oh, yeah. So. No, what we used transaction atomic for was if there's a failure anywhere through this, undo everything. Don't commit it. And so it wasn't as much for race conditions, but what we used it for was when we were calling a method that was, obviously calling a series of methods or procedures, and it was fairly complicated and it was error prone. We needed to be able to kind of pull the ripcord on that one and say never mind. Don't commit that. And so it wouldn't save it basically it wouldn't save a broken object to the database because something through that parsing and rendering failed. Otherwise, some of those steps would have stuck and persisted. I'm trying to remember how exactly we wrote it to do that, but it definitely accomplished what we were after there. And it would allow us to surface the error up to the top.
Yeah,
because we were a couple methods deep, and needed to get the error out of there and send it up because it was all about weird format related errors that we were trying to avoid.
And celery tasks too, on the celery task queue.
One weird thing that I've had to deal with before, and this may be particular to SQL Server, possibly. I don't know if I've ever seen it anywhere else. I guess. But you can get multiple record sets back as results. So completely different structured result sets, one above the other. And they come, for PHP, what we have to do is process them one record set at a time. So you take a look at, it's kind of like having a cursor. You take a look at the cursor to see if there's anything under there. You don't know how many you're going to get necessarily. And then you deal with the regular rows and columns inside another loop. And so I've not seen an ORM that actually handles that, but that's another one of those situations where almost always we've had to go up above the ORM to a higher level and or lower level, I guess, to process it. But again, I don't know. That may be particular to just one database.
Yeah, maybe. Because that sounds kind of familiar. I remember we had a project years ago that the original data was in a SQL Server database. They were in a Windows heavy environment, and we were migrating a lot of that to a Postgres environment. But I think they were still using that database for like whatever their software was running. And I remember there was something funky like that. That sounds like that's what it was in there. We had to write kind of a pipeline for to be able to handle that.
It seems like if it was more common across different database manufacturers, you probably have a tool that did that less messily. Yeah. Because it's awful code to see how it's processing. It's not nothing pleasing about it. Yeah. And then, of course, like if it's expecting more than one of those and it doesn't find it, it just, you know, sometimes you get really unexpected behavior.
You also get a cursor in Python. You can do cursor execute in Python. So
that might be how you solve that problem.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
I didn't want to lose sight of that when you mentioned cursor. I was just like, oh yeah, you can do that too. So get all the SQL in your Python. Except don't get any of the SQL in Python.
I fell in love with Django so much that I've tried early on trying to figure out how I could hotwire Django to be able to use the ORM at times. Like, I don't need a full web app, but, you know, I just need the Django ORM.
Now, that's where Rails got it right, because you can use Active Record, just Active Record, and that's really nice to decompose Rails that way.
Active Record is pretty nice. I like that.
Mm-hmm. That is sweet. And what's funny is it seems like that. What is
The Peewee database reminds me of Active Record and the querying and everything. I think it's heavily modeled after Active Record.
One thing that's kind of funny and almost kind of intuitive about like Django and even like DRF, because Python is so explicit versus implicit, look at the source code, encouraging all of that. Some of the most heavily relied on frameworks within the web world are not decomposable.
Mm-hmm.
And they come with a lot, and you just gotta like be happy with the bloat. So, like, you can't decompose Django and you can't decompose DRF, and you just gotta like eat it. There's this like this narrow space where you're like, maybe I don't need these things. Maybe I'm cool with just Flask and SQL Alchemy. Maybe I'm just cool with, or on the other side of that, maybe I'm just cool with writing a few APIs on my own where I'm rendering stuff to JSON. And then you just go like, no, I'm tired of this. And then you just like bring on literally all of the things.
But the benefit is worth the bloat like that. Yeah. Every time I've tried to do and do my own, I get to the point of like, now I need to authenticate. I'm like, crap, and now I need form validation. And I'm like, now I'm just building Django.
Now I'm just rebuilding Django. What am I even doing?
That just means that you got to think ahead, because if you do something and then you have to add more stuff later, you better think ahead before you do it.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where I kind of like, you know, in that paradigm, I like, you know, best of both worlds, right? So like you can use Django to handle your authentication, your user authorization and all that, and then let Flask, you know, be a microservice. And then that way you can let it just pass the token around inside the, you know, its own personal VPN between it and the web app. Is a nice mixture of both worlds, you know.
Well, that's where we're headed with one of our current main clients is going Flask for the microservices, because gosh, you don't want to use Django for a microservice. You want to talk about unnecessary overhead.
You know, we've tried it before in a way, you know, because like,
was it tiny Django? Is that right? Or mini Django? What is the
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, you could do that. But I was thinking of just even, you know, with Celery and task queues, you can almost think in a microservice kind of way like that. Yeah. But you're moving out of HTTP and REST or whatever kind of, you know, protocol I'm not finding the word I'm looking for, but, you know, the way of doing it that way. Because now you're doing it through Celery and message queues. Now you have to have like flow or something in there that you can peek into what's happening. And it's kind of nice to keep all that in HTTP and just use the same paradigms like that. And it's much more decouplable as well, I think. Yeah. You know, because otherwise you're kind of running the same, like if you're in a Docker environment, you're running the same image for your workers. And so every little microservice, you know, is all just using that same image, and then you can quickly get foot guns where you want to scale up one or you want to deploy one without deploying the others. And but you're deploying everything because it's that one image. So yeah, I definitely think we're leaning into Flask for microservices and Django just kind of for the web app on anything more complicated we're doing. Then that also gives us the option of if there are performance issues with Flask, it's not a huge chore to port that to Gen, you know, which is a Go micro framework, basically the Flask of the Go community or any, you know, Spring Boot or any of the more performant language, you know, micro frameworks out there.
Yeah, we kind of went a little bit overboard at a previous job with the microservices, kind of like over applied it. We weren't too bad about it, but the thinking was that we would split these things apart based on audience, you know, so that we didn't have to do too much crazy auth decision. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we were like, well, this is a bit much. Maybe we pull these things together that all talk to the same database. You know, that way we're minimizing the credentials that we have to manage and environments and everything. And that seemed like a pretty good middle ground because all of our front end was completely separated. So there was no point in doing, you know, a big monolith app with the views and everything. We were basically using controllers only because a lot of the logic was sitting inside procedures and stuff. But we found a middle ground, I guess, and it was pretty nice. But it's really nice to use those microservices where there's either a machine is the main consumer or another service. Like, those are my favorite because it's like they perfectly fit the bill.
Yeah, because then you can, you know, for me, it's even easier to think of like multi-processing that way of like this process is over there on a separate machine, even. It is a separate process, separate thread, all of that. And I can scale it horizontally, vertically, and horizontally, you know, get all that scalability out of it. It's really nice.
Yeah. And I guess anytime you got load that's disproportionate to the rest of the app, you know, you've got one outlier that's like getting a whole bunch of one particular type of traffic, then it's like, maybe that guy needs to be on his own.
And that'll be fun. That's a cool opportunity with what you've got going on with your main project, Daniel, is like figuring out the way to kind of offload that. One of the main pain points is an endpoint that's getting a lot of traffic to be offloaded somewhere. So you can go to whatever you want. Go nuts. Do it in Rust. We don't care.
It's our pain.
If you barely need anything, though, just go with Node.
I don't know. I'm not getting near enough sleep at night to tackle that.
But you could go with Node.
Node reminds me of my one story. I've got a quick story for like microservices and Node. Like, so we built this pipeline to do some document processing. And so one of the things we needed to do was text extraction. And so we had a couple of different microservices, and I think we had Uniconf running on a, I know we had it running on a microservice, and I think it was running behind a Node.js app. And we started getting some weird errors, and it was because like Node was just clobbering the poor, like, you know, process that it's running underneath there. And I remember on the Django side, which was dispatching the request to go hit that, putting a 1 second timer in there. Actually, I think I did on the Node.js side. Just every request that came in, I was like, just wait a second. Just
sleep.
Hold your horses.
Wait one.
Yeah, exactly. Wait one, because it would just get them and then try, you know, and they would try to fire up that process multiple times really quickly. And then I figured out, like, Node is just beating this thing up.
You know, Will, I give you grief for bringing up Node. Casey brought up the same thing, so you've got you're in good company with
Mitch. It's not a terrible idea, I guess. Yeah,
but I think I'll just chew on one new paradigm at a time.
That's probably a good idea.
I mean, like, let's just say you have something that's almost all front end, and you can't interact with this thing through the front end, so you have to make your own Node.js app and then interact with it or whatever, an API or something. And then that works perfectly fine because you don't want to deal with all that shit when you can have one page that just does one thing and you're good.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely use for it. For sure.
Yeah.
That'd be better than writing something unnecessarily bulky in another language.
I would I'd rather write Go, I think,
than performance though.
And Hopi or something. Hopi, I played around with Hopi. I think you know, to give like Node.js its due. Like Hopi is a pretty good framework for like microservice.
Okay.
Microservice type stuff.
I mean, if you want to do something really simple, you basically need like nothing. You can have like 10 lines.
It's really light.
You can do that with Python. You can write URL lib thing.
But then it would have to be running somewhere. It would have to be all that. And when you just have Node, it just runs itself. You just listen for the thing and it just runs itself.
Yeah.
Doesn't need anything behind it.
That's part of the issue with greenfields, or when you get the blank check like we're giving you, is we're just like, no, build it whatever you want. And now you're like, well, what am I going to build it in? So
wait, who are you talking about?
Oh, Daniel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we're gonna offload a bunch. He doesn't have one API that's getting a lot of traffic. I guess it's kind of what it is, but there's a traffic bottleneck with this application. I'll just to be real vague about it. We want to offload that traffic to ideally one API endpoint, and basically make it a microservice.
Node is fast as hell.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, Casey and Willow, to be clear, are not wrong in at least bringing it up for consideration. So.
I guess the tricky part
Oh God, I just scared myself. Here I am. I almost just said, just do it with Node and Mongo. And it would be so fast.
Just hit everything with the Mongo stick.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Here we are.
The tricky part might be like just seeing how much of the rest of the logic is touched with that one process, because, you know, there might be other ways to deal with the load. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does seem like it at first seems like a natural outlier that could possibly live by itself and pay its own rent.
Being a noisy neighbor.
Instead of mooching off its parents.
It's a very noisy neighbor right now, that's for sure.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and it, you know, if it increases the behavior and performance of everything else in the process, that's a nice plus as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the case necessarily, without getting further into it, but I'm sure we'll uncover those clues.
Were you able to get server access? Were you able to log in?
To the repo?
Question? Yeah, well, no. I was saying to the
Oh, I know what you're saying. I haven't tried that yet. I don't see why that wouldn't work.
Did you get into DreamHost?
DreamHost.
To DreamHost. No, I haven't tried. I don't think that will give me trouble. I did have a lot of trouble with another internal tool of ours that wasn't just letting me in at all. But I think Joseph figured it out. So.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah, that's
it was Jira. Very strange. We'll
call that one out. Jira is a punk. So
I thought it was like sessions stepping over sessions, but it had nothing to do with that. I opened it up in a completely different browser and started from scratch, and it was like undefined. It was like JavaScript.
Yeah, that is the worst. Can't read undefined of undefined.
It was so bad. I wasn't going to blame Java, but this was definitely JavaScript that was the problem.
Sometimes you can blame Java and the JSPA that Jira uses. I know they're heavy into that in a lot of places.
I got lucky. I only had to do one semester of that in college, and I didn't have to really mess with Java too much after that. It's a very particular beast.
I never have. That's why you don't go to college and get a programming degree.
I forgot.
Don't even get a programming degree. Girl, you don't.
I have mixed response on that. Like, there was, I got some things out of my CS degree that I may not have wanted to do on my own. The boring stuff, like, you know, figuring out how to document your process and being a little bit better about testing, that kind of thing. You don't necessarily want to do that stuff if you're teaching yourself, but having somebody kind of give you a scaffold for those ideas is helpful. The rest of the stuff, yeah, was maybe a little bit dated by the time we learned it, but
I got the stuff I needed and none of the stuff that I would make me hate it.
Yeah.
By doing
I got that,
you know, just HTML, CSS, JavaScript, a little bit of,
I could see that.
You know, no Java, none of that.
I took a Python class when I was at NTI, and that was good. 'Cause like one of the things that concerned me about getting into writing code after just doing it, you know, as a hobby for years, was a lot of that stuff you just said, Daniel, like the fundamentals of like, I know I can hack a thing together, but I don't know anything about unit testing or any of that OOP, you know? And so it was nice that my mentor would push me, because I was always like, it works. Like it passes the criteria. And he would say, yeah, no, that's good. Now think about how to make that object oriented and just, you know, different things. All he was doing is trying to get me to think about it in different ways. And I did. And that was helpful. That did provide value.
I'm not going to say it wasn't stuff that I couldn't have learned another way. It's just probably I wouldn't have been as motivated to do it if I didn't have a grade coming for it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
People that I know that did the actual computer science stuff, they just got turned off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I had a friend who went all the way up through his masters in CS, and he might have gotten. Yeah, he might have kept going. I don't know. Had a hard time landing his first gig right out of the gate because he was overqualified for everything as a recent grad, and the rest of us who, you know, didn't quite have as good grades as he did, landed stuff pretty quickly and of varying degrees of success, because like I'm pretty sure right out of the gate I was doing PHP, but I had been learning .NET in college, so you know, trade-offs. I think we were at like .NET 1.1 back then. It was like in ancient times. It's good old days.
.NET new days.
And before that, it was, you know, good old Borland. So that was
cool. You lost me on that one. I don't know Borland. I'm gonna have to Google that.
Borland C++, man. It was good times. It was different. It was different. You still are doing a lot of DOS commands and everything to compile, and I think hey, I would have learned that better on Unix if I had known that I could have done that.
Writing Hello World and stuff like that, there's no returns. At least with like web development and stuff, there's high return value.
Yeah, you get more immediate results, and you know, every time you refresh, you get a cookie.
You have to get some results, otherwise you're just not gonna keep doing it because it feels like you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
I started getting inspired whenever I started playing around with JavaScript and stuff around MySpace times. This was when I could when it started to feel like, hey, I think I can hack the machines now. And, you know,
you just cram a bunch of code into the CSS.
Oh man, it was the Wild West, and it was great.
Good old days. I think a lot of people probably got introduced to web development that way.
Yeah,
at least in our age group.
It made it feel approachable. It was like somebody just kind of took one of the panels off, and I could look in and was like, "Oh, that's all it is. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I think I get that." Because otherwise, you're like Willow, like you said, you're going from like print Hello World to, you know, websites on web servers, and that's just that, you know, nothing popped there for me until I could start making things.
Print Hello World to like now master sorting algorithms. Like, there's nothing enjoyable about mastering sorting out like write your own sorting algorithms. It's just like okay, and I get the value of it. Don't get me wrong. Like you need to learn that kind of stuff, but just learning that kind of stuff because it's next in the curriculum versus something that you need and you understand the use case for it and like the value of it, you learn it in two very different ways.
Once I got into web scraping for information for reasons that benefited me highly personally, yeah, that's when it really started making sense.
Yeah. So, good. The utilitarian in us all will win eventually. So, that's why I know how to do basic electrical work around the house.
Yeah.
I knew just enough to kill myself and and enjoy Electroboom YouTube videos. If you don't know Electroboom, you need to.
So. Nice, so I'll flick that up.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, like I don't know. Do they want kids in college or high school doing web scraping? Because it's like they're not going to tell you. They're not going to tell you like, oh, do whatever you want. Do Pirate Bay links, okay? Get sort by highest seed value.
I'm going to tell you that. No one wants to make the next Kim.com as their top graduate from their class.
Yeah.
Cheat on your homework. Aggregate these Wikipedia articles and scrape the information.
I don't know what Willow's talking about. I don't understand. I don't know anything. No, but like, you know, like Casey puts it, you know, like all we do in web development is concatenate strings. Like that's That's the extent of our computer science. And it is more often than not, like, even, you know, I think back to jQuery code, especially writing that, you know, that stuff back in the day, and literally concatenating a div giant string, you know?
Yeah. Now what you got, the whatever it's called. I can't even think of what it's called. The backticks.
Oh yeah. The
no concatenation needed with those things.
Yeah, the forbid strings make things real nice.
Yeah.
Real nice. Don't get pluses all over the place.
Whenever we had that one thing that I did, all the that JavaScript stuff had it did not have any of that. It just had string concatenation, which was ugly. And made it like 10 times longer than I needed to be.
With like the, you talking about that like WordPress view plugin or?
Yeah. The first one.
Oh, yeah. That wasn't even a WordPress view plugin. That was straight up WordPress plugin.
Oof. Yeah. Those can be kind of rough. Yeah. That's gotten a little bit better. They're like looking at integrating Composer and some of their dependency management out a different way, kind of flowing with what the rest of PHP is doing. So, and their UI is a complete rewrite as well, too. I don't remember what they called it, but it's supposed to be, you know, the folks that really liked the old UI for WordPress are real upset with the change, but a lot of the folks that are kind of new really appreciate it. So, you know, typical.
You know about like the backend UI?
Yeah, the administrative interface.
Wow, that's been around forever. I didn't know they updated that.
Yeah, it's now more JS, I think. I cannot remember what they called it, but
Is it even on the internet if it's not JavaScript?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Have you seen where they have now? Maybe this is what you're talking about. I don't think it is though. Where it's like it's just like a WordPress. And it takes your WordPress site and converts it to an API so that you can just build a site. Like
headless WordPress kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They have started exposing that a little bit more.
Yeah. I've looked at doing that with like Wagtail, which is a Django CMS.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a headless Drupal. I forget where it's at, kind of in its life cycle. But yeah, headless CMSs are a good thing when done correctly, but
that's not easy to do.
Yeah,
you're sure not going to make the WordPress one a GraphQL.
What's that?
It was, yeah.
You're not going to make WordPress like a GraphQL,
like a headless WordPress that's GraphQL endpoints instead of REST endpoints.
That's not going to happen. Not until 10 years after something else comes after GraphQL, and they're like, hey, we upgraded GraphQL.
I think someone will do it. I just don't think it'll be officially supported. Because surely there's room in the WordPress world. There are GraphQL enthusiasts in the WordPress world, I would think. Maybe not. Mm. I mean, that's not a slight on the community there, but I mean,
calling them barbarians, is that it?
No. Hey, everybody loves a good hammer and a good, you know, a good hand lathe and all kinds of stuff. I mean, Ron Swanson would build stuff in PHP and WordPress, I'm pretty sure. No. Awesome. All right. Now that I've called a huge swath of people that are my my peers in the industry, let's go ahead and close the podcast now. Anybody else have anything before we wrap it up?
Are you sure we've bashed JavaScript enough? Because that seems like
I've got a clicker I've been keeping up over here. We're a little light for this episode, but I think we'll be all right.
We got a whole year though to make up for it, you know.
We always make up for our JavaScript light episodes when Blake comes on.
Yeah,
JavaScript hate and
comes right here.
Yeah. Blake's got this monumental task of defending the whole language and.
Yeah. He's up for it.
An MPM and all that.
Yeah.
He's up to it.
He's up to it, though.
We just need to call every one of the episodes that he's on JavaScript in food trucks. And, because that's what we talk about when he's on. It's great. So, sweet. All right, guys. Well, have a great weekend. Everybody stay as warm as you can in the midst of turning into Antarctica. It'll be...
Yeah, it's chilly.
Yeah. We got our wood stove going, and it'll probably stay going for, like, the next week. So.
I think it's going to be gone within less than a week, though.
Oh, what? Think it's going to burn out before then?
Cold. Really cold weather.
Yeah, I know they're talking up to 12 inches for us by Monday. So.
It does say that, but then it says... It's only going to snow like 3 inches on each day. So I don't know.
They don't know either.
Like Sunday,
well, let's stick around day. Long enough to compound. Who knows?
Yeah. We'll see. Oh, God. I've got to. Someone opened the door and I just got cold.
Do we need to cut an intro or put that off?
You know, I don't know. I don't know how we're doing intros right now, so I think we should be good. And if we need to cut one, we can cut one in post. But we'll see what it's like. Yeah. I'm about to click the stop button. And we'll see what happens. Everybody?
Yeah, that looks like.
1, 2, 3. Every day you
hustling. Thanks for listening to Friday Afternoon Deploy, recorded and produced by the team at Lofty Labs. If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to future episodes via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also follow at Friday Deploy on Facebook and Twitter for episode previews, live streams, and other behind-the-scenes peeks. Past episodes and show notes on this episode can be found at friday.hirelofty.com. That's friday.hirelofty.com. If you'd like to contact the show, or if you're local to the Northwest Arkansas area and would like to be a guest on the show, you can email us at podcast@hirelofty.com.